The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Since the Syrian civil war broke out in 2011, Syrians have been hoping for peace and a return to some kind of normal life. But how difficult will it be after 13 years of civil war? And will this new era, following the fall of the Assad regime, lead to what they were hoping for? Now, to get a look into more what life was like on the ground and may be like in the future and the hopes of some there following the fall of the regime, I'm joined by Tony O'Riordan, a Jesuit who returned from Syria in June, having spent 3 years in that country. Tony, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
Now, two Syrias, that controlled by the government and that in the control of various rebel factions, which have now united to result in the fall of Damascus. So what was life like, first of all, in the areas controlled by the government? Was it stable? Was it orderly? Did people do a day's work and get paid appropriately for it?
So it might be helpful just to understand the size of Syria. So Syria is about 2.5 times the size of Ireland, and about two-thirds of it was controlled by the Assad regime and other parts controlled by the rebels in the north and the Kurds in the east. And, of course, Turkey occupies a part and Syria or Israel occupies a part of the south. In the Assad-controlled areas in the 3 years I was there, there was relative security, but there was also security that was imposed by a culture of fear, and you know, people were very, very cautious about what they could say. I don't think they were particularly supportive of the regime, but they were forced to just get on with their daily lives, which was phenomenally difficult. Every day was a battle for survival, for food, for medical care, for education, and looking to the horizon for the future. One way of understanding it might be to in 2011, the local currency, the Syrian pound, was worth $40. By 2022, one Syrian pound was worth $1 was worth 14,000 Syrian pounds.
So the collapse of the currency, effectively.
The collapse of the currency with rising prices and, of course, no significant change in people's income. So people were spending all their income on trying to provide food, often sacrificing things like healthcare. So one of the things we were doing was providing primary healthcare services in eastern Aleppo for about 50,000 people. And so often we would hear that unless we were able to operate and provide the medical care and the drugs for you know, just common acute conditions like infections or for chronic diseases like blood pressure medication, people wouldn't have been able to access those medications. And of course, we were only serving a small proportion of the population of Syria. It's about 20 million. 17 million of whom are living in extreme poverty. Mm-hmm.
So, the reason that the currency collapsed and the reason that times were so tough, was it down to sanctions on Syria that they couldn't trade like normal countries might trade?
I mean, this was a very significant factor, but also the isolation of Syria, the complete lack and destruction of infrastructure, you know, factories, the capacity to generate electricity. Most people, if you were lucky, were receiving maybe 4 hours of electricity a day. And that includes, you know, the production sectors and industry. And also like the huge exodus of people. So like seven million people fled Syria in the course of the civil war. So all those factors combined, and also a significant degree of corruption, so that prices kept on escalating, incomes. So like, you know, people in the public sector, like teachers, doctors, nurses, would be earning about $30-$40 a month. Whereas, I was always amazed, because it seemed to me that to live in any basic standard, it would cost you almost that to live for a week.
And these were the, if you like, the privileged few who had those kind of jobs. So they were getting enough money to kind of just about subsist, but no more than that.
Exactly. And that included about 2 million children who were out of school and were working in child labour. Like, one of the things that struck me every morning is that you'd see armies of small children pulling large trolleys and collecting particularly plastic, which was kind of a valuable commodity, which they would then sell on for a small price, which was then recycled and reused. And teachers in schools, I saw, they didn't have enough of income from the school, so they would find a second job. And of course, that impacted on their presence in the school and also their prioritizing teaching. So the education system, even for the children in school, was very, very poor.
Now, besides, you know, the sanctions taking effect on Syria and obviously spending whatever monies they were spending on armaments to buy the latest military equipment, I know they weren't paying their army very well, and often soldiers had to have second jobs to which they were more dedicated, perhaps, than their dedication to the armed forces. But besides all of that, what was it about Assad that rendered him incapable of running a country?
I think it probably became the fact that he became isolated. You know, he wasn't able to, probably for his own security, mingle, and the information he was getting probably was filtered through. And I even as late as Saturday evening, state TV in Syria was broadcasting that Damascus was safe and secure and that we will take back Aleppo. Now, I don't know whether that was Assad himself believing that this was possible, even at that stage, as rebels had entered Damascus. So I suspect, I think dictators often lose touch with reality and maybe a sense of not understanding how unpopular he was or how...
You can recall maybe the fall of the Ceausescu's in Romania, and when he was making a speech to a huge crowd, he seemed to be astonished and shocked that they were booing him. And within days, he was put up against a wall and was shot.
Yes, I think this is the nature of dictatorship at the end of the day. I don't think even Assad understood how much his people were suffering and how difficult life has been for the last 10 years. And that's why I think in these days there is a huge sense of relief. But as I was talking to a young medical student this morning, and he put it very well. He said, "What has changed in the last few days that the president is gone and the army are gone, but very little else has changed." And I think most Syrians now are they're fearful for what might happen. They're very grateful that the transition has happened without the bloodshed that many were anticipating last week, if there was a fight back from the regime supported by the Russians. So they're grateful that that hasn't happened, but they're very fearful for the day-to-day needs of bread and heating. Syria gets very cold these days, and for the next 2 or 3 months, it'll be very cold. So people are very wondering how they will survive and how things will get back to normal for the basics. And then the medium to long-term picture of, will the transition be to a better regime? These are the concerns at the moment. And I think a lot of Syrians are hoping that the international community can make positive noises to support a positive transition, you know, and including the possible lifting of sanctions.
Now, when the leaders of the rebels and this man al-Julani seems to be the power broker in all of this, he is the main man who's managed to get them all to fight together. He is making appropriate noises that, you know, we want to keep the prime minister in place. We want to keep civil administration as far as possible in place. People's jobs are safe if they want them. We don't want to hunt out all the so-called enemies of the new state. they probably have the wisdom, I hope they do, to look at what happened in Iraq when the Ba'ath Party was eliminated from all aspects of government, which effectively they've been running, and in Afghanistan, where the Taliban promised the earth and then decided to become as repressive, if not more repressive than before. And, you know, it hasn't helped the Taliban in terms of their international place in the world.
Yes, I guess what I saw in my 3 years in Syria, so I was leading a team of about 400 Syrians of all different religions and backgrounds, and we were working together as one team for the good of the people. And I think Syrians have this great capacity to step outside their identity for the good of the country, and they have a real strong sense of Syrian identity with its diversity. So I hope that's a huge resource to the new, that will inform the new regime, and that the new regime can draw upon to kind of lead us in a direction away from the kind of Taliban style of repression and into a Syria where the minorities are respected, and where there's freedom of thought and freedom of contribution.
It'll be interesting to see what happens to the Alawite community, of course, from which Assad came, and whether or not they are subject to any persecution, because if they are given tolerance, that would be an indicator of what might lie ahead.
Yes, and I was talking to one of my Alawite friends in Damascus this morning, and he's quite nervous, but he was also telling me that, you know, the rebels that now control Latakia, which would be the heartland of the Alawite community, that, you know, there has been no repression of Alawites, or no bloodletting. So that's a hopeful sign. And also what we're seeing in Aleppo is there's been a respect for the Christians and the Alawites and the Shiites in the city. So the early days, there are some positive signs that the regime are backing up its words with its actions. I mean, I think there's a huge challenge probably to make this transition, but there are some grounds to be hopeful.
And Tony, did you have any experience at all in the rebel-held areas to give us a sense of how they ran things when they were in charge? I know they didn't have resources of government and so on, but they were in charge. Do we know anything of the way people were allowed to live under the control of the rebels?
I only have one anecdotal story, and it was the Latin bishop, the Roman Catholic bishop for Syria, was appointed in the last 12 months, and he had been a parish priest in Idlib. And when he was appointed by Pope Francis to be the bishop, the local authorities showed great interest in acknowledging his appointment, and invited him and a large number of the Christians for a celebration of this appointment, which I see as a, I mean, it might be a token gesture, but at least it's indicating tolerance and respect for other traditions. And the fact that a Christian community was able to survive in Idlib again gives rise for hope. There are also some other anecdotes of some repression. But maybe because it was a territory under siege, that maybe there was a greater paranoia of dissent. So hopefully we can look to the positive of what was happening in Idlib, and that might be the way that the whole of Syria can go now.
All right, Tony, thank you very much for joining us. That's Tony O'Riordan, a Jesuit who returned back from Syria after 3 years, returned back last June.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.